This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. It's April, and so what that means to me and a whole lot of people is that it is once again National Poetry Month. And we're going to celebrate that tonight by listening to a good number of poets reading their own work. I'll begin by playing a couple of recordings by the late Audrianne Rich. She described herself as a white, middle-class, lesbian, Jewish poet. She was a feminist. She died in March of 2012. And I have two separate recordings to play for you. The first one was recorded in 1991. And I want to start with this because at the very beginning, she addresses the importance of poetry. And then following that 1991 recording, I'm going to play a small segment of a reading that she gave way back in 1968. So here we are, almost 30 years apart, two different readings by Audrianne Rich. Here we go.
I believe that poetry is one of our great human resources, and often a strangely wasted resource, like so many others, in the United States. At a time when extremely sophisticated tactics are being employed to disinform and demoralize us as a people, I believe that poetry speaks not from a separate sphere, but in a different voice. The book from which I'm going to read is a book shaped by living as a particular kind of citizen, a white, middle-class woman, a lesbian, a Jew, in the United States of America at the end of the 20th century. In the title poem of the book from which I'm going to read tonight, the overarching consciousness is that of this kind of citizen, reflecting on history, on landscape, politics, and people, some of whose voices, women's voices and men's voices, are heard in the poem. But I want to begin with a poem that I wrote last August, and it's very short, and it's called "What Kind of Times Are These?" And it takes its title from a poem by the German communist playwright and poet Bertolt Brecht, in which he says, "What kind of times are these when to talk about trees is almost a crime because it means keeping silent about so many evil deeds? What kind of times are these? There's a place between two stands of trees where the grass grows uphill and the old revolutionary road breaks off into shadows. Near a meeting house abandoned by the persecuted who disappeared into those shadows. I've walked there picking mushrooms at the edge of dread. But don't be fooled. This isn't a Russian poem. This is not somewhere else, but here. Our country moving closer to its own truth and dread, its own ways of making people disappear. I won't tell you where the place is, the dark mesh of the woods meeting the unmarked strip of light, ghost-ridden crossroads, leaf mold paradise. I know already who wants to buy it, sell it, make it disappear. And I won't tell you where it is, so why do I tell you anything? Because you still listen. Because in times like these, to have you listen at all, it's necessary to talk about trees."
A poem about a painting that's in the Smith College Gallery. It's by an American primitive painter named Edwin Romanzo Elmer, who lived from 1850 to 1923, and who painted, who lived in Western Massachusetts and painted a scene on the death of his daughter, a child, a girl named Effie, in which the house in which he lived, the painter himself, his wife, and the child, and her little wicker pram, and her doll are seen in a very faithful, primitive, rather wooden and yet somehow inspired landscape. Very New England, very Western Massachusetts. And this is called Morning Picture. It's, the poem is titled after the painting, and it's supposed to be spoken by the girl, Effie, who's dead. And I've used her as, in a sense, the daemon, the genius loci of the painting, seeing it all from beyond. And the poem really is tied to that vision of the painting. There's an allusion to a town in it. After the child died, Elmer and his wife couldn't go on living in the house, and they moved to a town called Baptist Corner, some miles away. They've carried the mahogany chair and the cane rocker out under the lilac bush, and my father and mother darkly sit there in black clothes. Our clabbered house stands fast on its hill. My doll lies in her wicker pram, gazing at Western Massachusetts. This was our world. I could remake each shaft of grass, feeling its rasp on my fingers. Draw out the map of every lilac leaf, or the net of veins on my father's grief-tranced hand. Out of my head, half-bursting, still-filling, the dream condenses. Shadows, crystals, ceilings, meadows, globes of dew. Under the dull green of the lilacs, out in the light carving each spoke of the pram, the turned porch pillars, under high early summer clouds, I am Effie, visible and invisible, remembering and remembered. They will move from the house, give the toys and pets away. Mute and rigid with loss, my mother will ride the train to Baptist Corner. The silk spool will run bare. I tell you, the thread that bound us lies faint as a web in the dew. Should I make you world again, could I give back the leaf its skeleton, the air its early summer cloud, the house its noonday presence shadowless, and leave this out? I am Effie, you are my dream. This is called Spring Thunder. It was written in spring of 1965. And this is a longer poem in brief sections. And it begins with someone sitting in a room in an ordinary street. A street is in a perfectly ordinary neighborhood, and hearing thunder somewhere. Thunder is all it is, and yet my street becomes a crack in the western hemisphere, my house a fragile nest of grasses. The radio telescope flings its nets at random. A child is crying. Not from hunger, not from pain, more likely impotence. The generals are sweltering in the room with a thousand eyes. Red hot lights flash off and on inside air-conditioned skulls. Underfoot, a land mass, puffed up with bad faith and fatigue, goes lumbering onward, old raft in the swollen waters. Unreformed Huck and Jim watching the tangled yellow shores rush by. Whatever you are that weeps over the blistered riverbeds and the cracked skin of cities, you are not on our side. I, never seeking our eyes, shedding its griefs like stars over our hectic indifference, whispered monologue, subverting space with its tears, mourning the mournable, nailing the pale gray woolly flower back to its ledge. The power of the dinosaur is ours, to die inflicting death, trampling the nested grasses. Power of dead grass to catch fire. Power of ash to whirl off the burnt heap in the wind's own time. A soldier is here, an ancient figure, generalized as a basalt mask, breathes like a rabbit, an Eskimo, strips to an older and simpler thing. No criminal, no hero, merely a shadow cast by the conflagration that here burns down, or there leaps higher, but always in the shape of fire, always the method of fire, casting automatically these shadows. Over him, over you, a great roof is rising, a great wall, no temporary shelter. Did you tell yourself these beams would melt, these fiery blocks dissolve? Did you choose to build this thing? Have you stepped back to see what it is? It is immense. It has porches, catacombs. It is provisioned like the pyramids for eternity. Its buttresses beat back the air with iron tendons. It is the first flying cathedral, eating its parishes by the light of the moon. It is the refinery of pure abstraction, a total logic rising obscurely between one man and the old effective clouds.
This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to recordings of the late Audrian Rich reading her work. In March of 2015, the world lost another major poet, the Swedish poet Tomas Tranströmer, T-R-A-N-S-T-R-O-M-E-R. He was a Nobel Prize winner. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2011. And he also won the Lifetime Recognition Award from the Griffin Trust for Excellence in Poetry. And I have a recording that I got from somewhere of Robert Haas paying tribute to him when he received this prize. So here we move on now to Robert Haas introducing Tomas Tranströmer.
I don't think there is a working poet alive who reads poetry in translation who doesn't think that Tomas Tranströmer is one of the masters, perhaps the master of the art alive at this moment. Tomas was born in 1930. That is to say, he's in the poetic generation after Miloš and Octavio Paz. And it means to say that in Scandinavian arts, he's in the generation after Ingmar Bergman. He was raised in Stockholm. His father was a reporter. His mother was a teacher. He went to a classical high school, a Latin school, which turns out to be important for something austere and elegant in his work. By the time he was 22 or 23 years old, he published a first slim book of poems called 17 Poems, which in another 12 years had been translated into most of the languages that people were translating poetry into. Tomas is the most translated poet into English of all living poets. I think the only poets who are more often translated are Rumi, Neruda, and Rilke. After that, Tranströmer. Why is he such an amazing poet? It's difficult to say, but somehow, of the artists of the period 1950 to 2000, more than any other single poet, it seems to me, Tomas's poetry gave a piercing sense of what it's like to be an ordinary person going about their life at the moment when that life goes off the tracks. If you found the moment when the car went off the road, the traffic, it had stopped, your heart was beating, you were still alive, and everything was still going on, trains went by, cars went by, stars overhead continued to do their thing, and you were sitting there with your beating heart wondering who and what the hell you were. That's the moment that he writes about. It comes out of the existentialism of the post-war period, comes out of something in Northern Protestant sensibility. It comes out of the way he, in his particular way, put together something out of Swedish Romanticism, something out of French Surrealism, something out of classical tradition, to make this singular voice that became a kind of voice of conscience for all of us. Speaking about poets, he wrote, Shiki and Ungaretti are writing with life's chalk on death's blackboard. In another poem, December evening, 1972, he writes, I'm driving past the locked up white church. A wooden saint is standing in there smiling, helpless, as if they had taken away his glasses. He is alone. Everything else is now, now, now. The law of gravity pressing us against our work by day and against our beds by night, and the war. December 1972, living with the Vietnam War in the way that we now live with the violence in Iraq. In 1990, Tomas had a stroke that left him paralyzed entirely on his right side and for a period without the ability to speak. So all the poets in the world were aware that one of the master poets in any language in that period had lost the power of speech, which was felt like a symbolic act. Tomas worked as a psychologist. He made his living as a psychologist to juveniles in prison, to drug addicts, to people between jobs and depressed. He ran groups. He worked as a citizen in the state, and his poetry belongs to the commuter in us. Looking at the headlights in front of him, he sees it as a long red dragon when everybody hits their lights and says, you are a scale on that dragon. It's that consciousness of being alive that he brings on guard duty when he's doing his work. One of his most famous poems, he says, task to be where I am. Even when I'm in this solemn and absurd role, I am still the place where creation works on itself. And that sense of what poetry does runs through his work. When he had the stroke, his wife Monica, whom you will meet in a moment and who was a nurse, drove into Stockholm and bought, because Tomas loved playing the piano, the entire Western literature for piano for the left hand, I'm told, and brought it back and said, Tomas, get to work. So that once he recovered his speech, And he recovered his poetry and produced the last two of the 12 remarkable books of poetry he wrote. He also has produced a record of piano literature for the left hand. And that would not be a bad definition of one of the roles of poetry in the 20th century. We're honored by his presence here. So please welcome Thomas Tranströmer.
De släcker lampan och dess vita kupar skimrar ett ögonblick innan den löses upp som en tablett i ett glas mörker. Sedan lyftas. Hotellets väggar skjuter upp i himmelsmörkret. Kärlekens rörelser har mojnat och de sover. Men deras hemligaste tankar möts som när två färger möts och flyter in i varann på det våta pappret i en skolpojksmålning. Det är mörkt och tyst, men staden har ryckt närmare i natt med släckta fönster. Husen kom. De står i hopträngd väntan, mycket nära. En folkmassa med uttryckslösa ansikten.
It's one of the pleasures of my life to be on the stage with this man. That poem is called, in English, The Couple. They turn out the lamplight and its white globe glimmers for a moment. An aspirin rising and falling, then dissolving in a glass of darkness. Around them, the hotel walls slide like a backdrop up into the night sky. Love's drama has died down, and they're sleeping now, but their dreams will meet as colors meet and bleed into each other in the dampened pages of a child's painting book. All around is dark and silent. The city has drawn in, extinguishing its windows. The houses have approached. They crowd in close, attentive, this audience of cancelled faces.
That was Robert Hass introducing the work of Thomas Tranströmer, and that was not Tranströmer reading his poem. I believe it was the Scottish poet Robin Robertson. I wanted to read a poem by Thomas Tranströmer. In his introduction, Robert Hass mentions how Tranströmer would write during that time. For instance, when a car is out of control and before an accident, and that's when you expect something to happen with Tranströmer. So here is a two-part poem by him. It appears in his book, The Half-Finished Heaven, which was published in 2001, I believe, and it was translated by Robert Bly. The poem is called Solitude. 1. Right here I was nearly killed one night in February. My car slewed on the ice sideways into the other lane. The oncoming cars, their headlights came nearer. My name, my daughters, my job slipped free and fell behind silently, farther and farther back. I was anonymous, like a schoolboy in a lot surrounded by enemies. The approaching traffic had powerful lights. They shone on me while I turned and turned the wheel in a transparent fear that moved like egg white. The seconds lengthened out, making more room. They grew long as hospital buildings. It felt as if you could just take it easy and loaf a bit before the smash came. Then firm land appeared, a helping sand grain, or a marvelous gust of wind. The car took hold and fishtailed back across the road. A signpost shot up, snapped off, a ringing sound, tossed into the dark. Came all quiet. I sat there in my seatbelt and watched someone tramp through the blowing snow to see what had become of me. 2. I have been walking a while on the frozen Swedish fields, and I have seen no one. In other parts of the world, people are born, live, and die in a constant human crush. To be visible all the time, to live in a swarm of eyes, surely that leaves its mark on the face, features overlaid with clay. The low voices rise and fall as they divide up heaven, shadows, grains of sand. I have to be by myself 10 minutes every morning, 10 minutes every night, and nothing to be done. We all line up to ask each other for help. Millions. 1. Now here is a poem written by William Butler Yeats, Down by the Sally Gardens, and it is sung by the wonderful late Kathleen Ferrier. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. We are celebrating National Poetry Month, and I just can't even think about doing that without Lawrence Ferlinghetti. He turned 96 years old in March of 2015, still sharp as a tack, as they say. So here are several by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I'll end his segment with the first 5 cuts from Oconee Island of the Mind.
History of the airplane. And the Wright brothers said they thought they had invented something that could make peace on Earth. if the Wrong Brothers didn't get hold of it. When their wonderful flying machine took off at Kitty Hawk into the kingdom of birds. But the Parliament of Birds was freaked out by this man-made bird and fled to heaven. And then the famous Spirit of St. Louis took off eastward and flew across the great pond with Lindy at the controls in his leather helmet and goggles, hoping to sight the doves of peace, but he did not, even though he circled Versailles. And then the famous Yankee Clipper took off in the opposite direction and flew across the terrific Pacific, but the Pacific doves were frighted by this strange amphibious bird and hid in the Orient sky. And then the famous Flying Fortress took off, bristling with guns and testosterone to make the world safe for peace and capitalism. But the birds of peace were nowhere to be found before or after Hiroshima. And so then clever men built bigger and faster flying machines, and these great man-made birds with jet plumage flew higher than any real birds and seemed about to fly into the sun and melt their wings and, like Icarus, crash to earth. And the Wright brothers were long forgotten in the high-flying bombers that now began to visit their blessings on various third worlds, all the while claiming they were searching for doves of peace. And they kept flying and flying until they flew right into the 21st century, and then one fine day a third world struck back and stormed the great plains and flew them straight into the beating heart of skyscraper America, where there were no aviaries and no parliaments of doves, and in a blinding flash, America became a part of the scorched earth of the world. And a wind of ashes blows across the land, and for one long moment in eternity, there is chaos and despair, and buried loves and voices, cries and whispers fill the air everywhere. Allen Ginsberg dying. Allen Ginsberg is dying. It's in all the papers. It's on the evening news. A great poet is dying, but his voice won't die. His voice is on the land, in lower Manhattan, in his own bed. He is dying. There's nothing to do about it. He is dying the death that everyone dies. He is dying the death of the poet. He has a telephone in his hand, and he calls everyone from his bed in lower Manhattan. All around the world, late at night, the telephone is ringing. "This is Allen," the voice says. "Allen Ginsberg calling." How many times have they heard it? Over the long, great years. He doesn't have to say Ginsberg. All around the world, in the world of poets, there is only one Allen. "I wanted to tell you," he says. He tells them what's happening, what's coming down on him. Death, the dark lover, going down on him. His voice goes by satellite over the land, over the sea of Japan, where he once stood naked, trident in hand, like a young Neptune, a young man with black beard, standing on a stone beach. It is high tide, and the seabirds cry. The waves break over him now, and the seabirds cry. On the San Francisco waterfront, there is a high wind. There are great white caps lashing the Embarcadero. Alan is on the telephone. His voice is on the waves. I am reading Greek poetry. The sea is in it. Horses weep in it. The horses of Achilles weep in it. Here by the sea in San Francisco, where the waves weep. They make a sibilant sound, a sibylline sound. Alan, they whisper, Alan. Coney Island of the Mind. In Goya's greatest scenes, we seem to see the people of the world exactly at the moment when they first attain the title of suffering humanity. They writhe upon the page in a veritable rage of adversity, heaped up, groaning with babies and bayonets under cement skies, in an abstract landscape of blasted trees, bent statues, bats' wings and beaks, slippery gibbets, cadavers and carnivorous cars, and all the final hollering monsters of the imagination of disaster. They are so bloody real, it is as if they really still existed. And they do. Only the landscape is changed. They still are ranged along the roads, plagued by legionnaires, false windmills, and demented roosters. We are the same people, only further from home. On freeways 50 lanes wide, on a concrete continent, spaced with bland billboards illustrating imbecile illusions of happiness. The scene shows fewer tumbrils, but more strung-out citizens in painted cars. And they have strange license plates and engines that devour America. Sailing through the Straits of Deimos, we saw symbolic birds shrieking over us, while eager eagles hovered and elephants in bathtubs floated past us out to sea, strumming bent mandolins and bailing for Old Glory with their ears, while patriotic maidens wearing paper poppies and eating bonbons ran along the shores wailing after us, and while we lashed ourselves to masts and stopped our ears with chewing gum, dying donkeys on high hills sang low songs and gay cows flew away chanting Athenian anthems as their pods turned to tulips. And helicopters from Helios flew over us, dropping free railway tickets from Los Angeles to heaven and promising free elections. So that we set up mast and sail on that swart ship once more, and so set forth once more, forth upon the gobbly sea, loaded with liberated vestal virgins and discus throwers reading Walden. But shortly after reaching the strange suburban shores of that great American demi-democracy, looked at each other with a mild surprise, silent upon a peak in Darien. The poet's eye, obscenely seeing, sees the surface of the round world, with its drunk rooftops and wooden wazos on clotheslines, and its clay males and females with hot legs and rosebud breasts in rollaway beds, and its trees full of mysteries, and its Sunday parks and speechless statues, and its America with its ghost towns and empty Ellis Islands, and its surrealist landscape of mindless prairies, supermarkets, suburbs, steam-heated cemeteries, Cinerama holy days, and protesting cathedrals. A kiss-proof world of plastic toilet seats, Tampax and taxis, drugged store cowboys, and Las Vegas virgins, disowned Indians and cinemad matrons, un-Roman senators and conscientious non-objectors. And all the other fatal, shorn-up fragments of the immigrant's dream come too true and mislaid among the sunbathers. In a surrealist year of sandwich men and sunbathers, dead sunflowers and live telephones, housebroken politicos with party whips performed as usual in the rings of their sawdust circuses, where tumblers and human cannonballs fill the air like cries when some cool clown pressed an inedible mushroom button and an inaudible Sunday bomb fell down, catching the president at his prayers on the 19th green. Oh, it was a spring of fir leaves and cobalt flowers, when Cadillacs fell through the trees like rain, drowning the meadows with madness, while out of every imitation cloud dropped myriad wingless crowds of nutless Nagasaki survivors, and lost teacups full of ash floated by.
Sometime during eternity, some guys show up, and one of them who shows up real late is a kind of carpenter from some square-type place like Galilee. And he starts wailing and claiming he is hip to who made heaven and earth, and that the cat who really laid it on us is his dad. And moreover, he adds, it's all writ down on some scroll-type parchments, which some henchmen leave lying around the Dead Sea somewheres a long time ago, and which you won't even find for a couple of thousand years or so, or at least for 1947 of them to be exact. And even then, nobody really believes them, or me, for that matter. You're hot, they tell him. And they cool him. They stretch him on the tree to cool. And everybody after that is always making models of this tree with him hung up, and always crooning his name and calling him to come down and sit in on their combo, as if he is the king cat who's got the blow, or they can't quite make it. Only he don't come down from his tree. Him just hang there on his tree, looking real petered out and real cool. And also, according to a roundup of late world news, from the usual unreliable sources, real dead.
Okay, you've been listening to Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty performing the first five cuts of Coney Island of the Mind. Next up is Michael McClure performing with Ray Manzarek, the late keyboardist who once played with The Doors.
spank me with a rose. I'm headed for jail. Just headed for jail. See the little sparrow with her eyes on the hawk. Everything around, it's just more talk. Don't use a knife to pound in a nail. Spank me with a rose. I'm headed for jail. He's hungry, and sparrow tastes good. Feathers fall down by the side of the road. It's a long way back to where stars lie in bed. Spank me with a rose. Hawk, he's hungry, and sparrow tastes good. Spank me with a rose. It's a long way back to where a star is lying bed. I'm headed for jail. Don't use a knife. Pound in a nail. Put my hands in deep mud. Get the taste of the floor. Get the taste of the floor. When I look into the night, feet walk out the door. I'm always hungry. The look in your eyes. When I look into the night, your bare feet out the door. Rivers of pearls, barrels of snow. Rivers of tears, barrels of snow. Put my hands in deep mud. Get the taste of the floor. Spank me with a rose. Headed for jail. Long way back to where stars lie in bed. Spank me with a rose. Hawk, he's hungry. Sparrow tastes good. Don't use a knife. Pound it. Spank me with a rose. I'm headed for jail. Don't use a knife to pound in a nail. Thank you. so the owl hoots. So the owl hoots, turquoise, musk, white linen, deer in the yard, stag with antlers, boyhood in the park of the body that smells like the ocean as it washes on the green grass, your blue eyes, you looking with love. I'll leave you, and I ought to be scared as my skin wrinkles. The boy dreams of Grandpa. As I get huger, I become streams stretching into shadows of memories, just as I taste the blackberry, as the tiny white flies flurry around it. There is the blood where the thorn cuts me. Helicopters clatter over the canyon in sunlight. Blackness is just a mask of fat for somebody. The tiny white flies are making a cloud in the tears of the brambles. Swarming around the dark fruit. The clouds are alive. This cloud is alive. This cloud is alive, as the great horned owl hoots three calls. The pony of memory tramples the rattlesnake. Sunset colors of apricot and layers of black over the ocean. A puff of summer dust where the buckeye butterfly lands. Mystic wings of planets and scarlet nebulae. A lock on the machine gun under the bed. Faces twisted in pain from the old times when love hurts so much that it is spotlights filled with legs and mouths writhing. Nylon stockings filled with sentimental songs are stained with blackberry juice like my fingers. And I love you, your blue eyes. Crinkle of frost on the windows. This is all fog off the ocean coming over the lines of brown hills. Tailgating drivers behind me with stoic faces. city is a mammal vision in peaks of form. Jack Pumpkinhead is laughing with the Tin Man, and an axe falls through it all, showing the dry grain and the whorls. As I get huger, I become streams stretching into shadows of memories. Raphael found the rules and was free. Raphael found the rules and was free.
And that was Michael McClure performing with Ray Manzarek. That wraps up the poetry reading part of this show. So I want to bring to your attention that on Saturday, April 25th, the Word Temple Poetry Series is having another live free event at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts when Paul Hoover comes to read the poems of Maria Baranda. This won the 2014 Pen America Translation Fund Award from a field of 120 applicants. The name of Baranda's book is Nightmare Running on a Meadow of Absolute Light. And it's really quite something. She is one of Mexico's leading poets of the generation born in the 1960s and is a very powerful presence in all of Latin American poetry. So it's wonderful that Paul Hoover has translated her work and will be there that night. Along with Paul Hoover, with a really wonderful Michael Palmer is going to be with us. He is the author of so many books of poetry, including Madman with Broom, which is a collection of poems with Chinese translations by Yuntai Huang, published by the Oxford University Press. His latest collection of books is called The Laughter of the Sphinx, and it just came out in 2015 from New Directions. Now, along with Paul Hoover and Michael Palmer, we're not finished yet. We have a local poet celebrating her brand new collection of poems. Clara Rosamarda will open the evening with a reading from her chapbook from the Small Change series, and it is called Naked Branches. Clara is a Sonoma County poet, memoirist, and counselor, and she teaches creative writing as well. She co-created and coordinated the very successful program called Writer's Sampler, which takes place at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. So all of these poets will be at the Word Temple Poetry Series on Saturday, April 25th at 7 o'clock p.m. And I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.